In association with Newsarama, welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Tonight, and as you can tell by the music, a special Word Balloon After Dark, because we're talking to Ed Brubaker and Matt Fraction, longtime collaborators on the Immortal Iron Fist. Their run on that Marvel book is ending, but the collaboration will continue in a different way as they take on the X-Men. Ed has been writing the book, but Matt comes on as co-writer with issue 500 and beyond. The two talk about their plans for the X-Men. In addition, we'll talk about their individual books, such as The Invincible Iron Man for Fraction, Punisher War Journal, and Brubaker's books like Captain America, Daredevil, and of course Criminal. Before we get started, a couple announcements to make. Wordballoon.com is back up and running. So in addition to our usual homes at iTunes and MySpace and Comic Space and, of course, Newsarama, you can find the litany of Word Balloon episodes at www.wordballoon.com or just wordballoon.com. And also you can follow me on Twitter if you want, twitter.com/JohnWordBalloon. That's my ID. And further, if you're going to the Wizard World Chicago convention, make sure you stop by and say hi. I'll be roaming around, but Friday afternoon at 2 p.m. in the Jim Mooney Room, I will be part of a podcasting panel moderated by my good friend Sean McKeever, my good friend, because, of course, just like a restaurant, there's a picture of him enjoying a meal on my door. And also, the guys from Around Comics are going to be there. Scott Cederlin will be there. The Comic Book Queers, Alter Ego, Collected Comics Library, Chris Marshall will be there. So a lot of good friends. It should be a good time, and I hope if you are at the Wizard Chicago Convention, you stop by at our panel Friday afternoon, 2 p.m., the Jim Mooney Room. This episode of Word Balloon is brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. InStock Trades offers a variety of great trade paperbacks, hardcovers, essentials, omnibuses, absolute editions, and more, all at up to 35% or more off the cover price. And don't forget, if your order is $50 or more, you get free shipping. For instance, one of our guest books, Ed Brubaker's run on Daredevil. If you'd like Volume 1, Daredevil, Devil Inside and Out, the trade paperback retails for $14.99 at InStockTrades.com. It's just $9.44. And Matt Fraction's book, Punisher War Journal, Volume 2, Going Out West, featuring the Punisher in that great Punisher Captain America-inspired costume. The retail price on that, $17.99. The InStock Trades price, just $11.33. And, of course, don't forget their other site, Discount Comic Book Service at DCBService.com for all your pre-order needs. For all the details, go to InStockTrades at InStockTrades.com and Discount Comic Book Service at DCBService.com. All right, without further ado, let us put on our smoking jackets, grab our martinis and cigars, and kick back for a Word Balloon After Dark conversation with Ed Brubaker and Matt Fraction. Fraction provided the technology for the three-way call. Sometimes he his volume is a little bit lower than mine and Ed's, but you can hear him. He's there, and I just wanted to let you know as we go in.
All right, so we should start the actual interview.
We could do that.
We know a certain fjord in Norway, near where the cod gather in great shoals.
Ed, do you...
Ed, John Stank.
Ed, I've decided I'm going to do the entire podcast like drunk Orson Welles from...
And I will be John Houston.
There's no known way of saying an English sentence in which you begin the sentence with in and emphasize it. Give me a jury, show me how to say in the X-Men, and I'll go down on you. That's just idiotic. If you forgive me for saying that.
And every time I get asked a question, I will answer just by reading a section from Moby Dick.
Thank you. Buy the blue screen or whatever.
Yeah.
To make it look like the water. That was.
They were going to be reading from Moby Dick. It's a book that I wrote. Shut up.
But I read marvelously.
Are we rolling? Is it camera one or camera two? Excellent. Camera two.
I'm telling you, I've been watching a lot of Orson clips since our conversation. I watched him being interviewed by Michael Parkinson and Dick Cavett, and a good BBC documentary. All these YouTube things. It was killing me.
I've yet to watch it, but there's a torrent of a pilot for the Orson Welles talk show.
Oh my God!
Good evening.
If you look around on BitTorrent for.
Oh man.
Boys, X-Men 500 is nearly upon us. When does 500 start?
In
right
July.
After $4.99.
In July. There's no way in the English language you can start a sentence in July. It starts in July. In July it starts. It's idiotic, if you forgive me for saying so.
So there's one more part left, Ed, of the San Francisco story that we're currently on?
Oh, is that not out?
Well, that's what I was wondering, because
I think that one's out, like, next week or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very cool.
We ran a little bit behind.
That's okay. Hey, Choi did a great job on this arc. I've really enjoyed his art.
Oh, you haven't seen any anything yet. Wait till the next issue, like the huge battle scene that he did with Wolverine and Colossus and Omega Red is really cool.
Very cool.
Yeah, he just kicked serious ass.
So
when I say ass,
you can say Ed. You can say anything you want. You can swear whatever the hell you want to say. Don't worry. And obviously, Fraction's already talking like Orson Welles, so anything goes. It's okay.
Yeah, that's true.
We know a remote farm in Lincolnshire. Every July, peas grow.
Do you really?
Rarely in the field. We're talking about them growing, and she's picked them.
Now, I've talked to Fraction about the collaboration that's coming on X-Men. It sounds like it's kind of like Gotham Central in that you guys are going to be switching off on arcs, correct?
Yeah. It's exactly like Gotham Central now that you point that out.
Okay.
I get the night shift team, which is all the, like, you know, gay bondage characters, and then Matt gets all the day shift people, which is all the straight bondage characters.
Is there a core group, and then, you know, you guys will each have part of that core, or, like, really?
No, we're just using whoever.
Okay.
There's a core group, which is the most popular characters.
And one of the things we wanted to do with the San Francisco thing is put all the characters... I'm sorry, one of the things that we wanted to do with San Francisco is to put all of the X-Men in one place. We could pick and choose, like, yeah, Ed's going to have his favorites, I'm going to have my favorites, and we'll just sort of...
If you feel like using Iceman, you can. If you don't want to use Iceman, you know, you don't have to use him.
Okay.
Ed, you write that freaky character with the white cat goat... thing. I can't even pronounce the character's name, so I'm not writing the character. I can't even.
Oh, yeah. The alien skunk lady. Alien skunk cat lady. Yeah. Who talks like Yoda.
Yeah.
Well, that kind of answers the question, because, yeah, I was wondering how many more of the exotic X-Men we're going to see versus, you
Dude,
know,
they're in San Francisco.
Well, that's a good point, too.
It's clearly an opportunity and excuse for us to... use your favorites, you know, and not feel obligated. Like, oh man, if only Hepzibah was here. You know, if Ed wants to do Hepzibah, he can. I'm completely in love with the old Claremont and Sienkiewicz era New Mutants. So, like, I tend to write. I've gone to those people a lot.
Okay.
Yeah, Cannonball comes rocketing into a scene suddenly. You can be sure Matt wrote that.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, great, Karma's back. I wonder who wrote this.
Matt likes to say y'all and have one of the New Mutants show up.
True, I do. That's the only bit of accenting I do, because it's not really an accent. I mean, that's what I talk like that, so I
don't yeah.
But none of that, none of that
y'all.
Being a phonetic drawling or any of that.
How are y'all? When you do it, it sounds more like Jeeves and Wooster.
Dude, I'm about to go to Charlotte. I'm in North Carolina for 22 minutes, and like my cracker comes. I don't even get out of the airport, and I sound like Boss fucking Hog.
Your inner cracker. That's nice.
I spent most of ninth grade in Hawaii, and when we went to Hawaii last year, within like half of a day, I felt like I was about to start speaking pidgin English again.
Wow.
Like, and then I was like, wow, those surfers are going to totally kick my ass.
Kick the Holly's ass, exactly.
Yeah. Hey, Holly, you think that's funny? How's it?
Where were you in Hawaii?
Oh, Kauai.
Very
I
cool.
We totally went to like a resort thing. We went to like, you know, just do the really stupid, like, you know, we're just going to go. And my whole thing was I just wanted to hear the ocean and read books. And we went to one of those like total resort timeshare kind of places. We weren't there on a timeshare or anything. We were just, you know, renting a hotel room on the beach. But it was totally funny. There was like lots of people there who were clearly there for like the free timeshare trip.
Okay.
But it was beautiful. We went to Kauai, which I'd never been to before. Now they have direct flights from Seattle to Kauai.
Outstanding.
Kelly Sue used to date a surfer, like a pro surfer.
Oh, wow.
She's actually spent a lot of time in Hawaii. So I was like, oh, hey, I was going to go to Hawaii. She's kind of over it.
Done it.
I was like, hey, we get, like, when we're planning out our honeymoon, like, what about Hawaii? She's like, kind of over it. I'm like, oh.
Jesus. Well, how far do you guys, I mean, is there an overarching plot that you guys have co-written, or is it, you know, arc?
It's
arc?
Kind of like...
Written overstates it.
Yeah, written.
Okay.
Thought about.
We've got to kind of know where we're going almost.
It's sort of like a TV show, the way we sort of, you know, when the idea was floated to bring Matt on and sort of, you know, try to amp stuff up and change the way things have been going. And, you know, Axel was saying, you know, Uncanny would basically become like the main, this is the core title where all the core characters appear, and if you want to read like the core continuity, this is the book that you follow. And
it's the flagship of the line.
Okay. Yeah, it's the flagship title, and it's got the main characters in it, which is, you know, the main difference between everything up to Messiah Complex was I didn't really have the main popular characters because they were all in Astonishing.
Sure.
And now we get to use all those characters, and Astonishing sort of exists between the raindrops, or whatever that saying is. But the idea was that, you know, and we'll see how well we can actually pull this off since the artists we hired are all really slow. But the idea is that Matt and I would each, you know, write as
that,
much
that,
of this
that
stuff.
That sound you heard was Axel Alonso's neck just exploding.
Yeah. Well, the idea was that we would try to get the book out more often, like 18 or 20 or so times a year, like actually, you know, put the book out more often so it would appear, you know, almost on the frequency of, like, you know, not a TV show, obviously, but you know, about as many times a year as a TV show comes on.
Sure.
You know, and then we would, you know, so we have, like Buffy, there's, like, a big thing that you're building to at the end of each season, but you have a lot of little stories that go in between it that all sort of build towards it. That's,
okay.
That's our idea, I think.
That's cool. Now, you mentioned your artist.
We've got sort of little big landmarks along the way. And,
yeah.
A lot of kind of question marks, you know, so it's sort of, it doesn't feel like, oh, we've already written 3 years of comics.
Yeah.
There's enough kind of mystery involved that we're still, there's still kind of an adventure for us, writing-wise, getting there.
And part of bringing them...
We know enough, too, about where we're going that we
yeah.
plant seeds and do payoff. And, you know, starting in 500, we're planting seeds for, like, 530, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
We have, like, multiple epilogues at the end of the issue that all, like, have, you know... So that's one thing that I really dug about the book when I was a kid during the, like, Claremont Burn and Claremont Cockrum eras was all the subplots that were constantly running through the book, and I really missed that from, like, the modern era.
I don't know if it's apocryphal or not, but there's a story about Wheezy Simonson when she was editing the book, keeping a bulletin board with index cards on them of plot threads that Claremont had brought up and never resolved.
Yeah.
And whenever Chris would come in, like, every 6 months, and be like, that's it, I quit, I'm done, I'm spent. And she would just kind of literally turn around and randomly grab a note card off of it and hand it to him. And he would read it and go, like, oh, okay, I can do this. Would run off, and there'd be another.
Yeah, I also heard that that both Paul Smith
God,
and
careful,
John...
Careful, Ed.
Oh, what?
I don't know. I just want to see...
Oh, no, I wasn't going. I wasn't going to the Hellfire Club. no, I also heard that like both Paul Smith and John Byrne used to like get the plots from Claremont, which would be these really detailed, like 15-page long plots,
mm-hmm.
and they would just go through and put red lines through the stuff that they didn't want to draw, and just take the parts of the plot that sounded interesting to them. And they were like extra editors on the book because Claremont was putting so many plot lines in, which you can sense when you read those that there's like so much chaotic energy going on there. And you know, we forget now when we go back and read those how groundbreaking they were at the time, but.
Sure.
Nobody was really doing comics like that, and it's just funny, like to hear that and to hear that, you know, you know, you can see that the minute he got an artist who would draw everything that he would put into the plot when John Romita took over the book, and then the book was just like, wow, you just started 9 plot lines in one issue, and who's this Rachel chick from the future?
Right. Why don't we?
Like,
try
that's
to
like
win
issue
it?
One.
Well, that, and it sounds like these sub arcs are going to be. Fast little stories, which is great because I agree with you guys. I think that is the best way to do it. Have the overarching story, but at least keep people entertained with quicker, entertaining stories as you build up to the big crescendo. Is your first arc, Matt? Is it 3 issues?
Yeah, it's 3 issues, kind of spinning out of 500, so 4 issues if you need it.
Okay.
But it's really, it's ultimately, it's kind of Pixie's first story, and it's kind of the welcome to the X-Men, Pixie, hope you survive the experience. Thing, and it ends up setting up a bunch of other stuff, but for the most part, it's just a story about Pixie.
Yeah, and it totally sets up my story. So.
Yeah, and, you know what I mean? And each one will kind of build, but yeah, it's very light. It's kind of, this is what life is like in a city, you know, for the first time in their lives, the X-Men are surrounded by people who don't fear and hate them, but rather respect and envy them and covet them in a way. So
yeah, there's like wannabe mutants, you know? Like
sure.
Mutant-identified, non-mutant people, you know?
Yeah, and so it's a chance to kind of, it's everybody's, they're all fish out of the water, they're all in, or rather they're fish in new water, and Yeah, you know, so it's kind of it's a light, fun, you know, there's a new threat introduced, but a lot of it's sort of about establishing the status quo in its way. And then Edge is kind of building momentum from there, and then my next one's going to build even more momentum, and then very suddenly it's going to get, or not suddenly, but sort of very gradually, it's going to get very serious and very heavy. But
that's probably when Iron Fist and all of the champions from the Seven Cities all join the X-Men.
Excellent.
Exactly. and then Matt Murdock defends them all, and they.
Yeah, there's a class action lawsuit against
Matt Murdock. Oh, that'd be great though if we move Daredevil back to San Francisco. You should totally do that.
I was totally going to have Daredevil like come to San Francisco for a storyline, and then we move the X-Men there. And I'm like, maybe not. But that would actually be kind of an interesting crossover. They've had X-Men Daredevil crossovers before,
sure.
I believe.
Absolutely,
they have. In the 70s, they had X-Men crossing over into lots of stuff.
Oh,
there's a really awful Captain America issue, which they cross over into.
The
just awful because of the art.
Okay.
It's the worst inking that Sal Buscema ever had. It looks like a coloring book. It's awful.
Yikes. I loved those Daredevil San Francisco stories, and seriously, that was one of my kind of hopes, was that maybe there would be some sort of crossover.
Well, that's the funny, that was part, you know, the Daredevil living in San Francisco was part of the idea for the X-Men living in San Francisco, because we were, you know, when we were sitting down and talking about what to do with the X-Men at post-Messiah Complex, you know, and it was yet again, the mansion had been destroyed and all this stuff. I just sort of threw out the idea because I remember Daredevil had lived in San Francisco, and I just thought, if I were the X-Men, I would move to San Francisco, like, get as far away from, like, you know, Tony Stark and all those people, and, you know, stop rebuilding your, you know, your mansion where there's, like, a huge target for any anti-mutant person in the world, and go somewhere where you're going to be able to let your freak flag fly and be loved.
X-shaped mansion that serves as a giant target from space.
Yeah, exactly. And it just seemed like, you know, why not go somewhere where people are going to think you're cool, actually? You can walk down the street with your wings out if you're Angel, and people will be like, hey, cool wings, man.
Why live in the graveyard from which, you know, your friends have died time and time and time again?
Yeah. You know, conveniently, I knew Axel had grown up there, so.
Oh, Axel?
We were really just pandering to Axel.
Yeah.
And you spent time there too, Ed, right?
Oh, yeah. I've lived there for a long time. Yeah, it's great to write locations where you actually, like, the fight scene in 500, like, I know the exact place that they're having the fight. Like, I visualized it completely in my head. I've been there many times.
What? Tell me about the artists that you guys each have for your runs. Ed, you start.
Well, we both share a little bit of Greg Land in 500.
Okay.
And then I think, did I end up getting all the Terry Dodson pages, or did you get one?
Yeah, I wrote the one panel.
You got one Terry Dodson panel. And most of the Greg Land issue, is Greg done completely with this?
Greg is done with 500.
And 501, I think.
And 501, let me see. He's not quite done.
And Terry's just started turning in. We've seen, like, the first four or five pages of his from, he doesn't do as many pages in 500, and then he's jumping ahead to 504,
yeah.
Like, in a couple of weeks. So, but yeah, it's great. I mean, I coming from Mike Choi, I was like, you know, you expect anything to be like a step down in a way, because Mike just puts so much.
You're already pretty spoiled starting.
Yeah, but you know, our hope is that Mike will end up being, you know, part of the rotating staff too, because we really like him and Sonia. You know, it's all sort of up in the air depending on how things go with sales and the schedule and everything. But, you know, Matt and Greg are doing the next three, and then Terry and I are doing the three after that. And, you know,
and
I think one of us is talking about doing we want to do things where not everything is like a two or three part story where, you know, there's one issue things here and there, and, you know, like a single character focus issue, something like that. Like, Matt, didn't you have some idea about a Colossus issue?
Yeah, I want to do this, it's such a half-baked idea at this point, but I want to do a thing where Colossus tries to get a tattoo.
Okay.
He's pretty heartbroken, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He's pretty devastated, and it seems like maybe getting thoroughly, getting a little drunk and going out and getting a tattoo is the kind of thing he might do to kind of commemorate his heartbreak, but he can't, like, let himself feel the pain, so every time the needle touches him, he metals up. So, but it's sort of about him letting himself feel this pain and like you know what I mean. Like it's such a that just sounds like such a sketchy idea. But that's kind of what I'm looking for.
He needs to wind up at like a silversmith or something like that to etch it on the armor, I guess. After a while,
exactly. Well, I want him to find another mutant who can actually put the like basically brand the steel. But you know, it's one of those things where it's like it's just like a self-contained. You know, kind of a character issue. Like Claremont used to do this so well. Like, hey, this is where the girls go shopping.
And that was that's my favorite parts of the X-Men. Honestly, is just the characters and you know, the you know, I always felt like the supervillain plots were almost just an excuse to have these characters that you just dug so much, like use their powers so that you could see why they were cool, other than like. You know, that they had cool sideburns or something.
It's an excuse to have the characters get totally fucked up and then need to do nothing but play baseball for an issue.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I'm curious because this is a group that, because of events and the feeling that there were too many mutants, they've pared down the number. But I really think both of you guys, but Matt especially lately, has been coming up with such interesting characters. Even the handful of... The Philippine heroes that came and went in that last issue of Iron Man, and I wonder if there's room
to count the Triumph division out so easily, my friend. Okay. That is what many supervillains make that same mistake, and they've paid the price dearly. So.
The Triumph.
That's why I stay out of Manila. I understand. Is there room to create new characters in this run of X-Men for you guys?
Yeah, we were talking about that the other day, as I had kind of written my first like big kind of group battle scene. A certain tactical deficiency on the team occurred to me, and I sort of talked to Ed about it. So,
The one thing that it's kind of funny because I remember being in the room when they were first talking about this whole 198 thing.
Yeah.
And the 198 was never like supposed to be a hard number. It was just like a guesstimate.
You know what the problem with that is? Is that it's a number.
Yeah, exactly. It's like hard numbers aren't numbers, and it's like, well, yeah, they are.
Yeah, that's why they call them numbers.
Yeah, so they started acting like the 198 was like a literal amount, and I was like, well, that can't possibly be because, you know, some of them die in every single, you know, issue that we have.
Okay.
It seems like, you know, some of these ones that, oh, you lived through it, you're one of the 198. It's like we never have a list of the exact who are these 198.
So that reminds me of one time in my earliest moments at Marvel. And I was trying to work out the Punisher Civil War stuff. I asked Warren Simons, my editor, if anywhere at Marvel was there a piece of paper that had written down everything that was going to happen in Civil War and what the landscape was going to look like at the end. And Warren laughed at me for like half an hour.
Nice. Well, and I mean, again, that's why I've been enjoying what I've been seeing in Iron Man. But also, I mean, and you just mentioned it, Iron Fist. I mean, you guys on your run, so many interesting characters and... I am looking forward to what Dwayne's got coming up, and I noticed that even in today's news...
Dude, does that sound great? Holy
yes.
crap,
yeah.
I can't wait for that.
Psyched for a new Orson Randall story coming up in September, so that's
I think
cool.
He only took the Iron Fist job so that he could write about Orson Randall.
I read that solicit, and I immediately wrote him like, dude, the second this is done, you have to send it to me.
Yeah, I know.
And I'm so glad you guys...
I love that they're going to continue to just do like one-shots and specials around, you know... conveniently hiring, you know, slow artists that are really good. Yeah. So you need to do one shot.
That's the thing, like, as a writer, like, this stuff, that kind of, like, continuity-free, like, let's play make-believe kind of crazy tune stuff, like, you can crank that so fast, you can just, you know...
Yeah, I totally want to do,
like... The Orson Randall special, like, it was one of the... The writing was just a joy, you know, and I wrote it all out of sequence, and it's just like, yeah, I'm gonna do this and that, and then... Yeah, it's just that stuff is so fun.
Yeah, that really seemed like the Orson's greatest hits kind of thing too, where you're just like any story that you had an idea for that this character would fit into, you could just
My friend Harold is doing that book at Image called Screamland, and mm-hmm. Frankenstein is a character in it. And we were talking about Frankenstein around Halloween and like how cool it was and how there were all the different kind of Frankenstein movies and all the different takes and all the different looks, and it's just like. I had, like, a couple days where I, like, fell in love with, like, the Frankenstein mythos, and then I was like, fuck it, Orson Randall meets Frankenstein. You know what I mean? Literally, it's that kind of, like, idea, like, it's that.
I always love the idea that a Frankenstein creature wouldn't stay a creature, that it would, like, that the scars would heal and it would become, like, a modern Prometheus. Like, it would actually become, like, a perfect specimen because it was rejuvenated life without, like, you know, the soul or the burden that, that like ties, you know, actual people down.
Like the Sting movie, The Bride?
Like this devil kind of creature almost.
Yeah, I'm glad you ignored me there. Did you hear me? I said like the Sting movie, The Bride?
Ooh.
Ah! Sorry. Fly
that was the movie that made them want to have him be Hellblazer, though, remember?
Hey, guys, remember when Sting was an actor?
Yeah.
He
was great in Quadrophenia.
I thought, yeah, I loved him in Quadrophenia.
No!
I did. I liked
it. My wife keeps letting the cat in, and he keeps, like, attacking me while I'm talking to you guys.
I thought it was...
Santris, did you watch the Cubs game, or did you just hear about it?
I did. No, I did watch the Cubs game.
I have it muted, and it's on. Was that Don Zimmer they just cut to? Is Don Zimmer watching this game?
Oh, I didn't notice if it was. Forgive the sports intrusion there, Brubaker. But yeah, I didn't.
Are you guys talking about curling again?
Yes. Don Zimmer is the Ed Brubaker of curling.
And he's got the plate
by
in
the
his
way,
head to
Ed,
prove
congratulations
it.
On being the best writer in all Canada. I haven't spoken to you since you won the Canadian of the Year award.
Did you? Yeah. Did you
win the Schuster award? I actually made Cameron Stewart get up and read a little statement that I wrote, which I said, I sent him this word for word. You have to get up and say, Ed wants me to thank you and say, does this mean he can move to Canada if Obama doesn't win? And then to point out how much I already love curling and the Toronto Maple Leafs, so I'm almost Canadian already. And I told him to emphasize the A really obnoxiously.
Your love, of course, for the CBC television programming as well.
Oh, yeah, I totally. Well, until their prime minister got my favorite show canceled.
Yeah, I know.
Bastard.
I was told we have to talk about that at the end of the conversation.
We talked about this earlier today, Suntress.
I know, I'm sorry. We'll keep that at the end of the conversation. Don't worry.
All right.
There'll be plenty of time for intelligence.
I told John earlier today that he couldn't say the I word because you guys would talk about it for 45 minutes.
Oh, yeah. I'm bummed I can't find my season one. So they sent me a season one, and I must have loaned it to somebody. I can't remember who.
Man, Derek Lee is having a great season.
All right, back to Iron Fist.
All right.
Now, I did talk to Matt about his thoughts on wrapping up and stuff. Brew, I mean, you know, the end is near, and I wonder, you know, because a lot of it, as you've explained to me, was as the process went on, kind of became, you know, it became more of Matt's book, and you were kind of, you know, the advisor on the book and stuff like that. So, you know, what are your feelings as you guys leave the project soon?
Well, I'm really proud of everything that we did. I mean, I wish that I had done more actual writing on some of them, but it became to the point where, you know, there was nothing for me to do. Like, we'd figured out what the story was going to be, and Matt was turning in scripts that didn't need me to, like, you know, read over them and cut out, like, you know, a bunch of his dialogue, because, you know, or a bunch of his narration. Like, he was getting, you know, Matt pretty quickly went from, you know, from not getting the monthly grind to completely, like, being on top of it and really streamlining his process. And, you know, he pretty much didn't need me by the time I was like, all right, I'm going to leave. And then, you know, but Matt's last issue, 16, is like the best issue of Iron Fist, you know, that we ever did. And I didn't really even have anything to do with it. So I sent Matt and David each like an email, and I was just like, you know, this issue makes me more proud than everything that we did on it. And, you know, I didn't even do anything. I think I cut out two words. I said in like to Warren, I'm like, I think you should cut these two words out. But
apparently Danny can't say motherfucker. Who knew?
Yeah.
Go figure.
No, he could say fucker, just not mother.
Ah.
You know, and I gotta
he watched say, his mother get eaten by wolves. He just doesn't say that word.
I see.
It's true. Yeah, it just drives him crazy.
Yeah. You'd know if you
well, it was like mother it was by like, wolves. It's like a dead men don't wear plaid. Whenever he hears cleaning woman, he goes into an insane rage.
Yeah, exactly.
I love
I have
that
plenty
movie.
Of time to wash and press your pajamas.
Already?
He did not listen to the Plastic Ono Band at all.
What was that?
Wow.
Yeah, I was...
as a guy who in a purely coincidental way, has been listening to a lot of the Plastic Ono Band these last couple of weeks, that is a beautiful reference.
Nice.
I have found myself going through a Plastic Ono Band phase. When we decided to quit, and it all kind of came about very suddenly at the Marvel Christmas party, in which, like, there's these pictures of Warren, and Simon's kind of looks like he's like he wants to cry, because we were sort of like, yeah, we're going to stop.
Yeah, that was great. Like, Warren had just told us, yeah, it's like, you know, this book is a hassle to get out every single time, but it's always worth it. And it's like, yeah, we're all leaving.
It'll be perfect because it's so. I was excited. And I was very happy, and I was convinced that it was like, it was a very with Ed leaving, it was a matter of time. It was a matter of Ed's time.
Okay.
You know what I mean? I don't mean like it was a matter of time before Ed left, but I meant like Ed was out. Like it didn't have the time to do it. It was a priority issue.
Okay.
With me, I think that's fair to say.
Yeah. No, I just I didn't. It was becoming, you know, something.
You felt superfluous, and it was a month. Yeah, I mean, it's just a thing that like your energy was better spent elsewhere. And I with me, I felt when we made the decision to leave that it was as close to a brave decision as I could get because I felt like I was really in a groove.
Okay.
I felt like it was as good as I could get on that. You know what I mean? Like that is it. That is my Iron Fist A game. I felt like that's where we were. We were by the end of Seven Cities and we were there. We were like, this is what I can bring to this book right now. And so the idea of leaving, it felt like, as of leaving at the top, you know what I mean? And so, and it became like admirable, like, wow, I don't know if I'll ever have the confidence and the courage in my career ever again to leave when I feel like I'm as good as I can be on a book, to kind of like get off the stage at London Calling rather than crap out Sandinista.
We talked about
which
that.
Which is a metaphor I've used before. And I didn't regret it, until David Aja turned in pages for the last issue.
Oh, yeah.
When I saw Misty Knight's bedroom, I swear to God, my knees buckled and it gave me pause, and I had like an afternoon of like, what the fuck did I do? Oh my God.
Yeah. It is a weird thing. It's like Bendis talking about leaving Daredevil, or it's like breaking up with someone that you're not having any problems with. I was surprised that Matt was leaving, but I could understand because, you know, it was getting harder and harder for Aja to do the books, and so clearly he wasn't going to be the regular artist, and I was leaving, and no one wants to be the last guy at the party when you started with your friends, you know.
Sure.
Like,
nobody. I didn't want to turn into.
He doesn't want to be the. He doesn't want to be the one guy left in the Human League.
Wow, Human League is a better reference.
Nice.
He doesn't want to be Ian Curtis without the rest of Joy Division.
Well, and I was, poor me, I was thinking of poor Greg Rucka left holding the Gotham Central bag when.
That's why Greg ended the book. He's like, you know, I didn't, you know, he had his last stories that he needed to tell, and then that was it. He was like, I don't want to be the only one here at the party.
Yeah, that was it.
Poor Greg Rucka, by the way.
No, I understand. He's doing fine.
There's stuff going on behind the scenes there that had nothing to do with Greg or Michael or I that sort of led to Michael leaving the book in the first place, and then, you know, that led to me leaving the book. So
there was a part of me that honestly believed that wanted deep down, like I wanted to pitch a Keystone Cops book so bad as a companion book to Gotham Central, then DC would have two books about police departments that didn't sell. But I love the Keystone Cops, the Keystone stuff. So I felt like a Keystone Cops would be great. It'd be like, oh, I had that all planned.
The irony.
Greg did that crossover with them too.
Yes, indeed.
Man, I know. I thought it would spin out of that again. It would be like a spit. You know, like a. It'd be like if. Never mind.
You get it was
an all cops of the.
I was about to make a Tortelli's spin-off reference about spinning a character out of the Tortelli's.
Well, from what I understand, there's at least one scene in the. In the upcoming Batman movie that is somehow an homage to something we did in Gotham Central, though Greg and I have no idea what it is, but supposedly there is something that's somewhat reminiscent of something we did in Gotham Central. So I can only assume it's the Joker interrogation room scene.
It's got to be from Dead Robin.
Did you guys get a pet?
No, I think it's from the Joker one, you know, when we did that Joker storyline, the soft target.
The sniper, yeah.
I'm sorry, I get my...
Yeah, no, I think it must be like the Joker in the interrogation room with the cops kind of moment or something, but I'm kind of excited about that, but at the same time, I'm kind of like, ooh.
Did you guys...
Hey, check out what you're not getting paid for.
I was going to say, did you guys get a check or no?
I don't think if they just, like, you know, use a scene that's similar to something you wrote in a Batman comic, you can expect anything. And I wouldn't anyway, you know.
Okay.
It's like, you know, I knew I was doing work for hire. If I created, like, a new character that they used or something, then, yeah, I would want something.
Wait, Ed, would you be pissed off if in the new Batman movie there was a rapist character named Brubaker? Would you be
only because they did that in Batlash.
And fights a rapist named Brubaker.
Wait, that was in the Daredevil movie, right? Quesada was the rapist in the
Daredevil movie. That's right.
Oh, wait, Ben Affleck killed in the first scene. He killed Joe Quesada in the first scene.
Oh, my God.
That's Jose Quesada. That's right.
I was, wow. I retract the joke.
Yeah. Nice one.
Nice.
But literally, I picked up that Batlash comic that John Severin's drawing, and the main character is at the end of the first issue, his name is Brubaker, and at the end of the first issue, he's about to rape Batlash's girlfriend, and I'm like, thanks. I kind of hope that they've never heard of me.
It was Sergio Aragonés. I was going to ask, what did you do to poor Sergio?
Well, Aragonés didn't actually write the script, though. He just wrote the storyline. So someone else wrote the actual dialogue. And I don't know who it is. I can't remember off the top of my head who it is, but it's not someone I know. So I'm hoping that they've never actually even heard of me.
Jesus. Well, we're talking. We've mentioned Rucka. I want to ask Ed about the current Daredevil arc that is being scripted by Rucka. Or how would you describe the writing chores?
No, we did it just like Gotham Central.
Okay.
Yeah, we co-plotted out, broke it down scene by scene, and tag-teamed 11 pages an issue, and then, you know, whoever turned their pages in last had to, like, you know, make all the scenes mesh up, just old-school style.
That's cool.
It was great just to have Greg back to sort of get my head into, like, a different, you know, Daredevil mindset. I was really, you know, I had this idea to do like a legal drama that Warren and I had come up with, like doing like a Matt takes a legal case to sort of get back into his head.
Okay.
And I just, you know, my schedule was looking really insane for a couple of months, and I just asked Warren if I could bring Greg on to help out, basically by co-writing, because, you know, it always went so fast when we co-wrote the Gotham Centrals, because, you know, we take a day or two to plot everything out on the phone, and then, you know, the scripts went really fast once we plotted it out. And as usual with each issue, just like on Gotham Central, like where our plan was to do with the next issue was always different by the time we got to write the next issue. We always ended up, you know, upping the stakes somehow or adding an extra twist, or Greg will always throw out the, what if we do this instead? And it's always like, oh man, now we got to change everything for next issue. But it worked out completely, and it was a lot of fun. It's fun to you know, to plot out a mystery with somebody and you know, read over each other's scenes and stuff like that. It was just kind of fun to get back into the groove. I had reread some of those Gotham Centrals looking, because they're going to start collecting them again. And
absolutely.
They're doing those 10-issue hardbacks, which I don't know if they're going to be oversized or comic-sized or what. But
what are they going to do, like an omnibus or something?
They're doing them 10 issues at a time. They're doing, like, I don't know why they're doing it that way. I guess because that's four, because there's 40 issues. And yeah, they're just collecting them in hardbacks. But I don't really know a lot about it. I don't know what the format is or anything like that. But I think they start pretty soon, because we were giving notes on them. But I was rereading, you know, some of the early ones and realized that there were little bits and pieces of those stories that I'd completely forgotten. And I liked doing something that was sort of that small in some weird way and that sort of personal. And I wanted to try to bring some of that over to Daredevil. I wanted to try and do, you know, something that felt like a more character-oriented mystery, as opposed to everything always being about Matt Murdock. And I also felt like that was kind of the point of the first couple of years, was to really, you know, to give Matt his life back, and then to sort of show him that, well, you know, after everything that Bendis put you through, you can never really get your life back.
Okay.
But then I also felt like he needed to have a story that was about him, you know, going outside of himself. Like, he needs to start realizing, you know, he can't just be the most navel-gazing, depressing superhero of all time.
Go ahead.
It fits, because he's got the Catholic guilt, and he has had a lot of really bad stuff happen to his girlfriends and wives.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Yeah, poor Mila, man. You put her through the ringer. Man, the poor thing.
If Bendis had just not brought her back at the last storyline, like, the last that we'd heard of her was, like, she'd asked Matt for a divorce, and Foggy talked him into signing the papers, and then she was gone for, like, a year and a half, and then, like, right as he gets arrested, like, you know, his wife shows up, like, the day before, and then, you know, he gets arrested, like, the next day. And I was just like, leave him in jail, but leaving him with a wife, it's just, you know, that's too much baggage.
Well, now, before I leave you and...
Yeah. No, I'm obviously kidding. Like, I really thought Mila was a cool character, but I did really want to do I wanted to do one of those stories that showed you, and it's funny, I did one story where the bad guy won, and everyone's like, every story Brubaker does, the bad guy wins. It's like, really? When else have I ever done one? I've done one Daredevil story where the bad guy won, and I think every other story I've ever done, you know, if it's not in Criminal, at least, where they're all bad guys.
Oh, yeah, but, and that, you know, that needs to constantly be punished.
Yeah, and I just like the idea that Matt gets a piece of his life back, and even getting his life back, just that spurred Mr. Fear on. It's like, you think you can get your life back? You know, you think you're special, Matt Murdock? Like, I love that there was a villain who his whole like, you know, motive was just, he's just never liked Matt Murdock. Everything always seemed to come too easy for Matt Murdock when they were in law school, and Matt Murdock was always the favored one, and he's really just like this petty guy who never got over law school.
You know the thing too about Spider-Man learned the power and responsibility lesson once with Uncle Ben.
Right.
Murdoch learns it daily.
Yeah.
Like, that's a propeller.
Murdoch, every time he gets happy, like he was, like, when he was in college and his dad was doing well and everything, and then that all got ripped away. It's like, he gets these, every year or so, he gets another reminder of that.
That guy is a jackpot bust, you know what I mean? There's no other camping in between. It's just...
He's kind of like a...
It's that Catholic guilt thing. It's what fuels him.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's the Catholic guilt, and he's kind of bipolar, but it's the world around him as opposed to him. You know, it's not like he's making it happen. It's actually happening, but it's like he should be afraid the next time he feels happy at all. He should be afraid instantly that it's going to be taken away, which is kind of what Mr. Fear's point was. And, you know, but it's something that obviously Matt has always been completely aware of because of, you know, his entire life.
Is there a side of Daredevil that Rucka has tapped into that didn't occur to you or any of the core characters?
A little bit. I mean, one of the things that we did, at least in the first couple issues, I wrote, like, all the Matt scenes, and he wrote more of the, like, Dakota and Foggy stuff.
Okay.
And then in the last two issues, it was just impossible to break it up so that it was that way, so we just divided them up more. I mean, what Greg really brings to it is sort of, you know, his own point of view on this stuff and asking questions about these characters that just hadn't even occurred to me yet. And, you know, immediately Greg wants to know more about Dakota North, and so I'm telling him everything I know about her, and it was like suddenly, like, a character I hadn't even thought to bring into the story was becoming part of the story. And it just, you know, things evolved that way. It was a lot of fun, and, you know, it was great because I hadn't, you know, I mean, Greg and I are still in touch, you know, but we don't talk as much as we did back in the old Gotham Central days, so it was great to have, you know, just a couple of months where we were talking a lot more often and seeing pages, and, you know, it's just kind of funny that, you know, Greg got to see exactly that Michael is exactly the same as he was then, which is completely, like, frantic over every detail of the comic and you know, drawing pages and then sending in these beautiful pages and going, this page sucks, and it's like... You know, no, it doesn't. It's just so funny how artists are like that. They turn in their best page and like, I think this thing sucks. Like, Steve Epting, I don't think has ever turned in a page he's liked the entire time we've been working on Captain America.
Jesus.
So.
Ugh. Now, we're going to get to Cap because I do want to talk about that. But, Matt, I want to bring you in because of Punisher War Journal. And obviously, you've gone from student and learning how to kind of meet the Marvel deadlines and kind of maybe conform to the mainstream. And now you're kind of teaching Remender. Is that a fair way to look at what's going on with you guys on Punisher War Journal?
Oh, I don't know I think there's definitely teaching is maybe the wrong way to put it.
Okay.
More like formatting.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like there's definitely a way to write sort of Marvel stuff in a way that...
Well, you gave Rick that gig just because he beat you that Halo tournament, right?
Yeah, we had a 3 out of 5. If I won, he would have given me back rubs. Any show, any time for 6 years.
Okay.
Back rubs. I got back rubs. If he won, I had to bring him. No. No, so it's just sort of... I mean, this is the thing when you kind of come from writing your own books, working in the indie world, and learning how to talk. But, you know, you have your own kind of way of communicating, and the Marvel system is a much different sort of sleeker kind of machine. So it's really a matter of Rick needing no help, but rather me just kind of bestowing the format kind of unto him. Like, oh, here, this is that, you know, and then...
Oh, you showed him how to use the modified Brubaker?
I did, and it's all jacked up. I always got to redo it. Like, I did something with the macros on his machine. His scripts,
it's
all
so funny because Rucka uses the modified Brubaker format. And,
so it's really the Rucka.
Before I knew him, so I think it might just be the Rucka.
It's the Rucka, and you're using a modified Rucka rather than a Brubaker.
I think mine might be a lazy Rucka.
Yours is a spectacular lazy Rucka.
Mine is almost unformatted. Like yours, when I see your scripts, they have so many numbers on them that I'm like, I can't be bothered to do the math.
So many numbers. There's no number. There's a number above each panel. There's the page in the panel. There's one number.
But there's the word balloon numbers too.
That's done on editorial. That is nothing on.
Oh, you don't do those. Oh, okay, good. Yeah. See, that just interrupts my flow. I can't be, you know.
Can you just
bother to know what number word balloon this is?
Can you let the layman in on the modified Brubaker or half Rucka or lazy Rucka that you're describing?
It's just our script formatting. Everyone has slightly different
write a
script
line
formatting.
Of text and then hit enter, and then write another line of text and hit enter. Just randomly, just make a list. That's it.
No, it's just purely technical boredom.
The other thing is too. Like I was really big on having page and panel number above a panel descriptor.
Okay.
Just in case, just for whatever reason. So an artist could always tell, okay, this is pages for that.
Because Matt grew up in the internet age when everything is 5.6 and 4.7. And
which means page 4, panel 7, and 5.6 would be page 5, panel 6. But also, I then would do a carriage return, so the panel description is under the panel, the page and panel number. Because I like it when
scripts
pull up a whole page, and I like to make it look like I'm writing more than I actually am.
I see.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that's why
it's Foster Wallace of comics.
Exactly. All my scripts have footnotes.
Jesus.
They're longer than the
actual. I feel like Val Kilmer on the Kiss Kiss Bang Bang soundtrack. Now I'm just trying to make weird references.
Well, feel free. This is
completely ruined that commentary track, by the way.
Really,
you're listening
does.
To Val Kilmer. Fuck you for ruining the Kiss Kiss Bang Bang soundtrack.
Yeah, Val's a big downloader.
Dan Downey and Shane Black go to really interesting places, and then Val Kilmer yucks it up, like, you know.
You know, since Spartan, I don't know what happened to that guy. I guess other than Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, obviously, but, you know, I don't know what happened. Great career. And not anymore.
He's a strange guy, I think.
He's a treasure. He's a national treasure. not so good on the commentary track.
Jesus.
Speaking of National Treasure, did you guys see National Treasure 2?
I did.
Like, how bad was that?
Incredibly bad.
Like,
don't tell me that. My dad loves those movies.
Well, I like
the first one, I will say, is at least fun for what it is, even though
absolutely.
It's impossible to believe that Nicolas Cage is a scientist.
Sure.
You know, I believe Elizabeth Shue was about to discover, like, the secret to DNA in The Saint more than I believe that Nicolas Cage has ever, like, read a book on history.
What about Denise Richards as Dr. Christmas Jones?
Yes, in The World Is Not Enough.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, she's complete. Wasn't she like a nuclear physicist?
I'm a nuclear physicist.
In tight shorts and a tank top. Yeah, of course you are, sweetheart.
She stripped her way all through nuclear physicist school.
Now, what was the zinger line at the end of the movie?
Of The World Is Not Enough? I couldn't say. Yeah, I don't know.
I thought it should have been, I can't remember what it was. I was really close. It was when the minute she said her name, like, I looked over to my friend Darren, and I said, like, I didn't quite have the zinger line. Like, it's something like, oh, my joke was like, oh, Christmas came early this year.
Yeah, something.
Oh, yeah, that's pretty good.
Oh, they say Christmas only comes once a year, or something like that. There was
kind of
Christmas coming joke that I was immediately when they said
Jesus.
Your inner Charlie Sheen came out.
Maybe we need Orson Welles in the National Treasure movies.
Yeah. Oh, he would be great.
Do it.
Listen, John Boyd. If you look underneath the seat of Abraham Lincoln, I know what I'm speaking of. There's no way in the English language that you can read the Declaration of Independence.
It's written on the back of John Dillinger's ballot, which is
I've drawn a treasure map on the back of this box of Mrs. Paul's fish sticks.
Do you have any lemon juice? So we can read this. Oh, my God. I see him waddling away from the National Archives with the Declaration of Independence under his arm.
Four. There's no way in the English language you can emphasize a sentence with four. If you show me four, it makes no sense.
Oh, God. Ed, Captain America, I'm, as always, enjoying it, and Matt Brady always beats me to every issue before I can, like, tell you, you know, how much I like the next issue.
Oh, thanks.
But I was happy to see the return of what looks like the 1950s Steve Rogers.
Oh, yeah.
And
I can't believe how nobody, like, a couple people on the internet guessed that, but that's, like, on one of those message boards where they're guessing everything.
Okay.
And, you know, I don't think it counts if you've guessed every single possibility than to go, I got it! It's like, yeah, well, you know, you guessed everything. It's either a clone, or it's Steve Rogers, or it's the Cap from the 50s, or it's a Cap from an alternate. It's got to be something. But I actually got worse email from that fake-out reveal where it turned out to be the 50s Cap than I got from killing Steve Rogers.
Really?
Like, I actually got an email from this woman, and I should almost read it over this thing, but it would be too long. But this woman said that that fake-out reveal was it. That was the last straw. She was never buying another Marvel comic again. I clearly didn't care about my readership and didn't care about my characters, and what I had just done in Captain America with that fake-out reveal where it didn't turn out to really be Steve Rogers, for all these people who'd been hanging on for the last year hoping to see Steve Rogers again, and to do that was worse than everything that DC had done to Sue Dibney. And
wow.
And then P.S., you're a misogynist pig for everything you're doing to Sharon Carter, too. And then I was like, I actually had to write back and just go, I'm sorry. Like, having a fake-out reveal that, like, this Steve Rogers turns out to be this other pre-established character from Captain America's history is worse than rape and murder and then being burned alive? Like how... You know, the scales are a little boggling.
A little bit.
But, yeah, that's, you know, I guess it makes sense because Bendis got, like, you know, more anger over killing Hawkeye in that Avengers Disassembled than I got over killing
Captain.
What? What?
A little bit behind. Don't.
Yeah, I was going to say. Matt's still on 2001.
Oh, sorry.
Alone.
He's back now.
Yeah, it's okay. Oh. Don't
and
worry.
And those Mockingbird. Me?
Apparently, yeah.
What? But, yeah, in the 70s. There was this character called Ma. But yeah, no, that was just, you know, but that was always my plan. And if anyone who's been following the book for, like, since I started writing on it, I've said many, many times that my very first issue of Captain America I ever bought, like, the very first time I went and bought comics with my own allowance, which was, like, 50 cents, was I bought Marvel Premiere number 16 and Captain America number 156, which, you know, like, the second appearance of Iron Fist and the big final part of the Cap of the 50s arc, where it was the two Caps, like, fighting on the cover.
On the beach, yeah.
I've said that so many times, I can't believe when somebody saw, you know, Dr. Faustus is part of this story, you know, I dropped all these hints, and then Sharon Carter sees a guy who looks just like Steve Rogers, and I'm like, everyone's going to know that that's the Cap from the 50s, and... You know, people were really shocked. So I was really glad because I always wanted to bring that character in.
Did she write back after you wrote her?
Well, I have no idea. I put her on my spam list. She's psycho.
I think we talked about this. I think this is that crazy girl that called us both racists for things we were going to do on Iron Fist.
Yeah, I think you might be right.
Wow.
There's some sketchy, you know.
She's gonna blow your bunny. You gotta be careful.
Every now and then, it doesn't happen that often, but, you know, I get a lot of email through my website. I get, you know, like, some every day, and about two or three times a year, you get one that just scares the shit out of you, where you're just like, Jesus Christ, is this person for real? Like,
yeah.
I've actually written back to people, you know, like, I try to, a couple times if it seems really bad, you want to try to diffuse it or something, or just remind them, it's like, well, you know, that's a comic book character, and I'm a real person, right? You know, just little things like that, but, you know, you also don't want to feed the freaks.
No, I can appreciate that. Well, it was always one of my favorite characters, too, that 50s Cap, and the explanation of those stories from the 50s.
Well, and I tied it in, like, really early, too, with, you know, ever since issue 6, where, you know, Jack Monroe's body is, like, blown to smithereens, you know, the plan was always going to be that the 50s Cap would come back and find that his Bucky had been killed by the real Bucky. Because, you know, it's one thing to have two guys who look like Steve Rogers running around, but it's a whole other thing to have multiple Buckies. That's too much.
Not in my book, pal.
Bucky, it's clearly enough.
The plural of that is Buckeye.
Buckeye. There you go.
They're like Buckeye, but without all the sex.
The well, and again, going back to the solicitations that I saw for September, Now I'm completely confused because it sounds like the Death of Captain America story is wrapping up in September. So that's interesting.
Well, the giant meta arc.
Yeah, September 2017.
Yeah. No, the Death of Captain America sort of overarching arc that began with issue 25 is coming to a conclusion, which the Death of Captain America, the giant sort of 18-issue meta arc that I ended up doing, started out as, you know, it was going to be, you know, this is year one of the book was the, you know, was all about Bucky and saving Bucky, and year two was all about sort of building up the bad guy. And year three was going to be about, you know, what's the world like without Cap, and you know, and mixing that in was, you know, this is the Red Skull's big plan finally happens, you know. And so those two storylines, you know, coalesced into, you know, what took a year and a half to do, basically. And so the conclusion isn't the conclusion of, you know, it's not like at the end of this, Cap is no longer dead, but it's the conclusion of the big Red Skull, you know, this ongoing plot where, you know, little bits and pieces of it are being moved here and there. It actually starts moving really fast over the next few months because, you know, when you have Arnim Zola and Dr. Faustus and the Red Skull all in a room together, it turns out, you know, they don't necessarily always play nice.
Yeah, go figure.
So, yeah. You get several evil madmen together, and it's best to try to enact your plan as quickly as possible.
Well,
listen, I'm not going to screw you guys over. You're not going to screw me over, right? Oh, no,
never.
No.
Yeah. it's this whole East Coast, Eastern Europe kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm sure. What I love is, and that's kind of my point was, and I guess I was oblique about it, but I really love the fact that I don't know when the hell you're going to bring Steve back. I don't care. The ride has been great. And it's great that you've been able to kind of spin this story that, you know, is still very much about Cap, and he's not in the book anymore, and Bucky's, you know.
Well, it really grew in the telling. I mean, I'm thankful that the book has done so well, and Joe and Dan have been, you know, more and more, like, just, you know, keep doing what you're doing. You know, everybody's loving it, and, you know, and it's like, wow, okay, I've got carte blanche to, you know, like, do Captain America and make it a cool book. Like, that's pretty awesome.
That's definitely a thing that was really cool to see in the last two editorial meetings, is how kind of, like everyone kind of, like, you get the sense that they're questions that they don't ask you because they don't want to ruin the book as readers.
Yeah. Good.
Like, they know that you know what you're doing, and they know that Tom knows where it's going, and if that's enough, they're just going to kind of, okay, well, they don't, like, nobody wants the specifics. Like, it's clear that that's a book that's very much beloved in the hallowed halls of Marvel.
No,
yeah, and conveniently, you know, ever since 25, especially, you know, 25 sold so many copies. It was, like, the biggest selling comic of the year last year, and, you know, we've had several high points, that Alex Ross, you know, the issue 34 with the new Cap cover and all that stuff. We've maintained, like, a significant sales bump over where we were before, you know, all the Civil War stuff started that, you know, I haven't actually witnessed any of this personally anyway, but at least at Marvel, anyone being forced to sort of shoehorn their book into a crossover, but there hasn't been any talk of that at all. It's like, you're in the middle of this huge epic story. You're not going to, like, stop for three issues to do, like, a crossover thing. So that was what was cool, was, like, sort of, you know, coordinating with Brian of, like, where the book was going to be so he could use, you know, New Cap, as we're calling him, with a U. Shiny Cap. But, man, did you see that Gabriel Delato cover?
I did.
I instantly made that my screen background. I was like, wow, look at that. There's my Cap with Thor and Iron Man right behind him. Like, that looks really fucking awesome.
Absolutely.
Wow, nice.
Well, and I wanted to ask
Iron Man.
Well, I want to get to Iron Man, but I want to ask about.
No, that was Ed. I was telling Ed, don't ruin Iron Man. Don't make Iron Man do anything stupid. I'll totally kill you.
Oh, no. It wasn't. It's for Secret Invasion. Talk to Brian.
I
never write Iron Man. I just write Tony Stark.
Well, first I want to ask about.
If you do that, make sure he wears a tux. That's the rule.
I always have him in a tie. Like, he just took the tux off, and he's just got his tie. Like he's stressed out. He hasn't slept for days, and he's like, "Why did I decide to run S.H.I.E.L.D.?"
Like Jerry Lewis at the end of the telethon, basically.
Exactly.
Okay.
Tony Stark is always Jerry Lewis at hour 29. Like, that is Tony would be.
Yeah. He's trying to imagine how we're going to get that last $1,000.
And, you know, and I got to say, every time Salvador does it, Salvador's like, "Okay, ties untied, beautiful."
Well, I was curious about, and given that Alex does the covers for so many of your Cap books, have you guys conferred with what he's doing? Alex Ross.
But he did that one cover.
Oh, he just did the one. Okay, fine. Well, regardless.
Yeah, no, Happening does all the covers.
Okay, I'm sorry. Well, what I wanted to know, though, was how his Invader story, did he talk to you at all in terms of, you know, where New Cap is and everything?
I heard a little bit of, like, what they have planned for it, and Tom is, you know, coordinating really well with them on that.
Okay.
And I think a lot of that, you know, since it's being published in coordination with Dynamite and everything, there's a lot of, like, hands in there already. There was a couple ideas bounced off of me that I was, you know, allowed to give feedback on in the early stages. But I, you know, I'm never the one to want to be, like, you know, stepping in someone else's thing. And you know, my main goal was, you know, just don't do anything that majorly conflicts with what I'm doing, and you can really do whatever the hell you want. You know, and you know, that's kind of how I feel about most things. I you know, when before Bucky put on the new Cap outfit, I was really like, you know, if anyone's going to use the Winter Soldier, I want to know, and I want to, you know, make sure everything works. And, you know, so I sort of have domain over Bucky to some degree.
Okay.
But, you know, like, they had a couple of really cool ideas that I was like, oh, that's cool. And there was one I was like, oh, I kind of wanted to have that moment, but I can't deny it, you know, because
okay,
it's going to take me like 3 years to get there. So
I loved when
stuff like that.
I loved what Dan Way did with Bucky in Wolverine Origins. I thought that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, there was actually, it was weird because there was some period of time where either Marvel's server or my server was having problems, because I read all of those scripts but one, and there was one issue, which was the only issue that I would have actually had any comments on. I think I had like a couple of little things here or there, like, oh, I don't think he would say this quite this way or this or that, but there was one issue of that I would have had like a major meta note on, and then that was the one issue that I didn't actually get to see the script at the time.
Okay.
So the issue, I bought the issue, and I'm like, man, I don't remember any of this stuff. And then I was like, oh, well.
All right.
like, all right, well, someday I'll just do a story that conflicts this completely.
How about when Matt was using Bucky in Punisher War Journal? Did you guys talk?
I wrote every single line of the that was another instance of, you know, Matt said, you know, this is what I'm going to do, and then I was like, I don't think he would rip the Punisher's testicles off and feed them to him. I just think he softened a bit.
Whatever. No, but then I ended up writing the final draft of that in your office, remember? And I would just
write, that's right.
When that time when we did all the X-Men playing, that trip. Yeah, I would just kind of
Matt came out and stayed here for like 5 days, and we each worked on different things sitting in my office. Then we took a trip down to Portland for one day and stayed at the Bendis's. And then we came back. And then the very last day before Matt was going to leave, we just suddenly, like, jammed through, like, 2 years of X-Men plots.
Yeah, like
partially in the car on the way to the airport.
Yeah, just scribbling down furiously in my notebook on the way to the airport.
Like. And then, like, a month later, we were at, like, a Marvel meeting, and Matt's, like, looking through this notebook, and he's like, what's the Sisterhood of Evil Mutants again?
You know,
Ed, why did I write they're all gay and circle nine times? What does that mean? What are we doing?
Yeah.
I think
is Leather Fist a character?
I'm making a huge mistake.
Is the X retreat coming around San Diego?
I don't know if we're allowed to talk about that or not.
Okay,
I'll know what the official plan is at this point. The last I heard was it was going to be just like last year, like after San Diego.
Okay.
But I've made my travel arrangements, assuming that is the case.
I was going to say, I can excise this if you'd rather, guys. It's okay.
Oh, no, I just don't know that there is.
We should, just in case.
Okay.
There was a,
don't worry.
Yeah, we should.
Consider it done. Don't worry about it. I'll move on.
There is no X retreat.
What are you talking about? Anyway, well, then by the same token, now that, Matt, you're sharing Iron Man, are you guys, like, honestly, like, do you guys have conversations of how Tony comes up in Cap and how you're using him, Ed?
What are you talking about?
Oh, no. I mean,
you're writing Iron Man now?
Yeah. No, you know that?
No, I'm just kidding. No, I think, well, when you write a character, you know, that...
Because Tony Stark right now is like the town bicycle, and everybody's getting a ride. So, like, be like, wait a minute, I'm writing. You don't get that. Like, that
okay.
He's too ubiquitous.
Well, you read Matt's Iron Man book, and it reads completely differently than, you know, the Iron Man Director of S.H.I.E.L.D. book. And,
yeah.
You know, and, you know, I mean, when you have any character that's in the Avengers, like, especially during the midst of, like, a huge, you know, Avengers storyline going on, you know, you feel like... Like, I've always tried to use other people's characters as sparingly as possible. Like, if a character has its own book, you know, and I want to use it, I'll, like, coordinate with the person doing the book. But when Tony Stark basically took over S.H.I.E.L.D., I'm like, well, I write Captain America, you know, which is a very S.H.I.E.L.D.-oriented comic, so there's no possible way I can do this without writing Tony Stark. And, you know, the guys who write the Iron Man books have always told me that they really like the way I write Tony Stark, so I'm like, oh, okay, good. Because I try to use him as sparingly as possible, but, you know, Cap is, you know, at least Steve Cap, you know, was a big part of the Avengers, so I always feel like if I want to, I can sort of grab any Avenger and just use them in an issue here or there, as long as I don't do anything, you know. You never change someone's continuity or do
sure.
something
yeah.
with someone else's character in your book, you know, like...
Okay, by the way, I had Tony Stark... yeah, no, you don't. Yeah.
It's, yeah,
it's yeah.
Just, that's just rude.
Okay.
You know, it's like... You don't have, like, the major reveal for someone else's character in your book when they're just, like, waltzing through for, like, a few scenes. You just use them for their connection to your character and, like, something that's
yeah.
cool about that.
So it's just sort of a delicate hand, and, you know, you give heads up where you can, and editorial all talks to each other, so everyone kind of knows what's going on with everything else. And, you know, you're respectful, you know what I mean?
I got you.
It's good. It's you know, it's like I said, it is tough with Tony, who is everywhere right now, you know?
So, yeah. One time I had him drawn in a S.H.I.E.L.D. outfit, and it felt so wrong that I was like, no, Tony Stark wouldn't wear, like, a skin-tight Nick Fury outfit. It just felt wrong for the character. And so every other time we've had him, I saw those pages, and I was kind of like, it's too late to get it fixed or changed.
Yeah, alternately, I did a thing in War Journal where I literally, anytime I write Tony Stark, I try to write him like in a tuxedo.
Yeah.
Where I did that in a War Journal issue, and Ariel drew him in the S.H.I.E.L.D. getup. And I was like, oh, okay. I mean, it's not like it's bad, but it's sort of like, oh, I wish it was, you know, I want to see, you know, Dean after the, you know, with the loosened, you know, I want him to look like Dean Martin.
Yeah, exactly. You want to? I want him in like a unbuttoned vest with like a loosely hanging tie and his sleeves rolled up and like 8 cups of coffee on the table in front of him.
And that's one of the jokes, not like joke, but it's one of the things that I've kind of gotten into with his character. The more I've written it, is it's kind of clear that he doesn't sleep because he's got no time to sleep. You know what I mean? Like he's too busy and doesn't necessarily miss it and really does it. There's a montage in the fourth issue. Where we get to see basically how Tony spends 2 weeks of his life.
Oh, cool.
Every you know, but like every couple of panels, he's somewhere completely different, doing something completely different in a completely different outfit. Because that's him. Because it's like this crazy, like, here's what 13 days looks like in the life of Tony Stark.
That's cool. You know, I'm amazed at how much, because obviously you were writing this before the film was released, but you really seem to be channeling the tone of the film
that second
issue.
That was total. That was super lucky.
Yeah.
That was. I wanted to. I just hoped against hope that they. I figured that they were going to make. You know, the movie was the movie, and all I could do was like, oh, I should write a comic that would match an Iron Man movie the way I would want an Iron Man movie to be. And luckily, hey, it ended up kind of feeling like not so far away from one another.
Yeah, both of them just feel like the most natural way to use the character and use the series. It reminds me of, you know, the years where I was actually reading Iron Man when I was a kid, like the, you know, when he was always fighting that guy with the Whiplash. Was that his
name?
Yeah,
Whiplash, absolutely.
Yeah, Whiplash. You gotta bring Whiplash back. But it reminds me of that era, like the, which I guess is that the, you know, the fabled
is that Stan and Gene Colan?
You know, it's
no,
the post-Colan. I'm thinking of, who's the guy who did the Demon in the Bottle story? I'm trying to blank. Right?
Oh, Leighton and Michelini.
Yeah, Michelini and Leighton. Yeah, that era of Iron Man. Like, some of that stuff reminds me of that. The movie reminded me of that a little bit. But then it also felt like, you know, like just taking little bits and pieces of all of that and sort of doing something that also feels really new. Like, the first hour of that movie, I had completely forgotten that Iron Man has like one of the most hardcore origins of any character. Actually, he's like exploded and has shrapnel in his heart, and then is forced to build a bomb for, you know, the bad guys, basically. And it's like, wow. And then he makes himself into a weapon.
You know, actually, I mean, most of that stuff was Denny O'Neil.
Yeah, that was like the original Iron Man.
The run up to 200 and all that sort of, which is, that's the thing, like, about the Demon in a Bottle storyline is, you know, that was really the beginning of like 4 years of stories.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
And he was, I mean, Tony Stark was out of his own book for like 2 years.
That's right, Jim Rhodes was there.
Yeah, Rhodey took over, right?
Rhodey took over, and Tony was literally drunk, wearing a tuxedo, gone from the book. You would see him every now and again, and he grew his hair long, and he had a beard.
Yeah,
I mean, that was all like Danny O'Neill came in around like 150 or so, and carried.
He had a kind of a Matt Fraction look going on.
Yeah, well, not anymore. Now this is great. Yet another convention season. Yet another completely different look. So this is good. You know, my picture's been in Wizard, and I tell them I don't look like it, and no one will recognize me. It's great.
Yeah, so
let's see. I'm looking now. I'm now going through. I'm trying to find when Danny O'Neill took over writing Iron Man.
I don't remember Danny O'Neill writing Iron Man.
Maybe with 160.
But that he wrote it pre-Michelini or after Michelini?
Oh, no, after.
Yeah, after.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he actually had a good run on Iron Man. I was a big... You know, Denny was great. Denny wrote everything great. I was always a fan of his.
But Denny really... Denny, talk about ballsy. Jesus Christ. I mean, not to wax your fucking car, Ed, but I mean, it's that same kind of thing. Like, take the main character out of the book for God knows how... You know, who? You know what I mean? Maybe for... Just go. You know what I mean? Like, that's how you do it. You buckle down. You make the decision to do it. And you do it.
See, I always thought that's what they should have done when they killed Superman. Not that I was reading the Superman books at the time, because the only Superman books I've ever been able to read are either Superboy and the Legion or like the Jimmy Olsen or Lois Lane comics from like the 50s and 60s. But seeing that happen.
I've been crazy for DC Silver Age stuff lately.
DC Silver Age. Actually, the old Adventure Comics Superman stories are pretty good sometimes. The Kurt Swan era.
Yep.
But there's nothing like Jimmy Olsen stories for me. Just, you know, those Jimmy Olsen and some of the Lois Lane, like with the Lois Lane Black Like Me. And
classic.
Going to Motorcycle Gang. And, you know, I love the really old ones, though. There's like a great one where... She thinks that she's figured out who Superman is, and she thinks that Superman is Bruce Wayne.
Okay.
And so Bruce Wayne asks Lois Lane to marry him, and it's all a practical joke that him and Clark Kent are pulling on her for always trying to figure out who Superman is. So she's about to get married to Bruce Wayne, and they're having this huge wedding, you know, of course, because he's a multimillionaire, and all of her family is there. And he's like, "Oh, we're ready, Lois. We're just waiting for the best man." And then Superman shows up to be the best man, and comes flying in, and she realizes, you know, that she can't marry this guy because she thought she was about to marry Superman, and you know, that's the big joke.
So she had sex with somebody. She's totally kind of something different. It's a little.
I don't think
like
they had sex. It was during the Sprang era.
No, that led to the storyline. Bruce Wayne, a consensual rapist.
I remember that. Sure.
Yeah.
A horrifying exploration of the politics of the bedroom and when no really things to know.
Did they burst?
Work.
I only wanted you because I thought you were Superman.
Did they burst out laughing?
I thought you were Batman.
Did they do the thing where they're like, "Silly Lois,
that was the end. Yeah, the last panel was actually them laughing at her as she's crying and her whole family is like embarrassed of her. And they're like, ha, ha, ha. They're like chuckling about it. And it's like the meanest comic
they
of all time. But
as Lois puts the gun in her mouth.
Yeah.
Don't you want to?
I'll never marry Superman.
It's times like those that don't you want to go back in time and meet Walt Weisinger and go, seriously, man, what the hell? Like, why do you hate women?
I don't think there's any.
Read
the
first 50 issues of the Fantastic Four sometime and just some of the ways that Reed talks to Sue.
That's true.
Oh, Sue, you're a woman. You wouldn't understand. Like, there's a lot of that.
It is kind of a bummer that the woman's power is to turn invisible.
Yeah.
I remember there was one where Willie Lumpkin comes in with a stack of mail, and they're reading, and a fan writes and says, you know, I love the whole Fantastic Four except Sue. She sucks. And then Reed really admonishes the writer and says, don't you remember the time that Sue saved us from Dr. Doom, and really only she could do it with her powers? And it really was this kind of like, hey, Sue's okay, and she's an equal member, and this is why she's important to the team. And I always thought that was kind of
interesting. She's actually the most powerful character on the whole team.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, across town, Mort Weisinger is lighting cigars. Hey, sweet tiff.
Yeah.
And then Bruce Wayne slaps
Clark Kent on the back.
Sue could actually defeat any, like, Sue could defeat Dr. Doom. She could just create an air bubble inside of his armor that just explodes out.
Sure.
You know.
Why don't we pause there for part one of this Word Balloon After Dark conversation with Ed Brubaker and Matt Fraction. Brew comes back in part two with a little talk about Criminal. And then, as usual, with both guys, we take that left turn into pop culture and just start randomly talking about all those movies and TV shows and different oddities that we all love. This episode of Word Balloon is brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com, where they offer a huge variety of absolute editions, omnibuses, trade paperbacks, hardcover editions, essentials, all the various products that you find at a reduced rate of 35% or more off the cover price. And in fact, if you have an order of $50 or more, you'll get free shipping. In fact, right now, InStockTrades.com has Volume 3 of Fraction's Punisher War Journal, Hunter Hunted, which featured that great arc with the Rhino and other Spider-Man villains as they face the Punisher. The standard retail price is $19.99, but at InStock Trades, you get the book for just $12.99. Or how about the hardcover of The Immortal Iron Fist, Volume 2, The Cities of Heaven, featuring that great Kung Fu tournament that we were just talking about. The standard retail price is $24.99. At InStockTrades.com, it's just $15.74. How about that? That's all happening at InStock Trades. For all the details and more deals, go to InStockTrades.com. Thanks again for listening. This is John Suntress. Don't forget, Word Balloon is all over the internet. We're at our home site, WordBalloon.com. We're also at Newsarama.com. And you can find us at iTunes, at our MySpace page, MySpace.com/WordBalloon, ComicSpace.com/WordBalloon. Follow me on Twitter, Twitter.com/JohnWordBalloon. And if you have any questions or comments about the show, you can always email me, John@WordBalloon.com. Part two coming up next time. Make sure you check it out. It will likely be up before the Wizard Chicago show. Once again, if you're going to that convention, be sure to stop by the podcast panel that will be going on Friday afternoon, 2 p.m. at the Wizard World Chicago Convention in the Jim Mooney Room. And I hope to see you there from 2 p.m. till 3. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2008.